that the prisoners are the symbol of the Palestinian cause and their issue is a priority, as the resistance wants it idle until all Palestinian prisoners are free. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. A civil rights advocacy group says the system that allowed African-American George Floyd's murder remains fully intact despite the conviction of a white ex-officer. India registers its highest daily deaths from the novel coronavirus amid reports that hospitals in New Delhi are running low on oxygen. Pakistan's TLP leaders call off nationwide protests after learning that a resolution will be tabled in Parliament to debate the French ambassador's expulsion. Hello and welcome everybody here in Iranian capital Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: last May, a white police officer in the U.S. from Minnesota knelt on the neck of a black man for over 9 minutes during an arrest that was captured on camera. The 46-year-old handcuffed man, George Floyd, repeatedly said that he could not breathe before he died. The incident then prompted months of protests against police racism and brutality in the U.S. Now, that officer, Derek Chauvin, has been found guilty of murder.
Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer, has been found guilty of the murder of African-American George Floyd.
We, the jury in the above entitled matter, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April, 2021, at 1:45 p.m.
Chauvin was convicted on all three charges against him: second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and manslaughter. The verdict was announced after a three-week trial that had the entire United States on edge. Major figures have now hailed the conviction as a watershed moment, with U.S. President Joe Biden calling the verdict a much too rare moment of justice.
I can't breathe. I can't breathe. Those are George Floyd's last words. We can't let those words die with him. This can be a giant step forward in the march toward justice in America. Let's also be clear that such a verdict is also much too rare.
And Floyd's family said they could breathe again.
People from Brazil, from Ghana, from Germany, everybody, London, Italy, they're all saying the same thing. We won't be able to breathe until you're able to breathe. Today, we are able to breathe again.
Floyd family's attorney called the moment important, not just for Floyd's legacy, but for the legacy of the United States. Witnesses, friends, civil rights activists, politicians, and the world of sports also weighed in on the jury's decision to convict Chauvin. Many people took to the streets in different U.S. cities to celebrate what they called a stunning historical moment.
This is a stunning moment in history. You know, a white police officer was actually convicted of murdering a black man that we saw on video. And while this is not justice because it won't bring George Floyd back, it is the start of accountability on the part of the police.
However, many say the verdict has been just the first step on a long path. Some say Floyd's death was not captured on camera, the court would not have even convicted Chauvin of the murder.
This is a very powerful, very positive moment, but let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. The system is still the system, and had it not been for the video, in fact, I just published a piece today, George Floyd minus video equals Trayvon Martin.
So without a doubt, the court's ruling is a historic moment in a country where law enforcement officers are rarely found guilty of killing civilians. In the words of Floyd's supporters, this has been the first big milestone, but a lot more needs to be done.
India's coronavirus outbreak sets new records with nearly 300,000 cases and more than 2,000 deaths in the last 24 hours. India's total infections have now reached 15.6 million, while its death toll is nearing 183,000. The country has seen an unabating increase in coronavirus cases in the past few weeks, reporting over 200,000 infections daily. The capital, New Delhi, imposed a weekly lockdown from Monday, and the virus epicenter, Maharashtra state, tightened restrictions. India is also facing a severe shortage of medical supplies, including oxygen and hospital beds. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has already urged the nation to step up efforts to curb the surge.
I appeal to the young people to form small committees in their societies, their neighborhoods, apartments, to help ensure COVID discipline is followed. If you do this, then governments won't have to make containment zones or enforce curfews and lockdowns. These steps won't be needed.
Modi also described the situation as a big fight against the pandemic, but urged the states to use lockdowns only as last resorts. This is while his government has been criticized for its lax rules that have allowed election rallies and religious gatherings. India is the world's second worst hit nation in terms of infections. After the U.S., it is also the fourth highest death toll worldwide. Munawar Zaman joins us now from New Delhi. Munawar, how worrying is the situation right now in India?
Well, one word, maybe two words perhaps. Terrifying, horrible, extremely unprecedented situation, which it's unbelievable to experience such a horror unfolding in this part of the world. In capital New Delhi yesterday, 30,000 cases in a day and more than 280 deaths in a single day. You wouldn't believe that there was shortage of places in the crematoriums to burn the loved ones or to cremate the loved ones. I mean, it is an unprecedented and alarming situation. And the TV channels that we see right now, every 24/7, are running news about this coronavirus, and it is creating a big time problem for people related to their mindset. And the mindset is such horrific that people are scared even of going outside their homes. I mean, it is unprecedented situation. As I said, in the first wave of COVID-19, I did not witness what I'm witnessing right now because the country was not prepared for this, Bardia. I mean, people are queuing up outside hospitals. There are no beds, there are no oxygen cylinders, there's lack of oxygen, lack of beddings, and lack of medical infrastructure. I mean, if you see disturbing images coming on social media, one can only feel that this is something which is an unprecedented, it's a crisis, it's just like a war, it's a silent war. They're fighting the coronavirus as it is, because the country did not anticipate that the second wave will be much more deadlier than what they thought about in October 2019. When the cases were gradually going down, the country's health minister said, okay, well, it's all done. We have won a great war over COVID-19. And at the same time, people started taking things for granted. And there was social distancing, public gatherings, schools, and all economic activities were gradually thrown open. I mean, there was social distancing was going for a toss. I mean, you know, The country's health system is already ailing. How could you put burden on the country's health sector when you know you don't have such resources? I mean, right now today, in the parts of New Delhi, there is a total lockdown. Police is ensuring that they make the lockdown successful because Bardia, they want to make sure that the chain is broken somehow. Even after announcing the lockdown yesterday, there were 300,000 cases. I mean, you just imagine the number of people living in this country is more than 1.3 billion people, and it's not easy to contain such a deadly epidemic and cater to such a huge population. There are people queuing up outside hospitals. You will see people hanging in the autos and in the ambulances and on the footpaths wearing the masks and breathing oxygen. I mean, if you go to the streets and joining the Ghaziabad, which is in Uttar Pradesh, I mean, you will see, it's a deadly situation. And sometimes I'm getting goosebumps myself. Okay. I mean, being a journalist, I feel like this is an unprecedented situation. Bardia, back to you.
All right, thanks a lot. What hours, Aman, joining us from New Delhi. Leaders of a political party in Pakistan have called off demonstrations in protest at the publication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad by French magazine. The decision by Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan came after the party learned that a resolution would be discussed in parliament in expelling the French ambassador to Islamabad. The TLP has waged an anti-France campaign for months since French President Emmanuel Macron defended a satirical magazine and republishing sacrilegious cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. The protests erupted into violence last week after the TLP leader was arrested over his demand to expel the French ambassador. France, rather, has drawn criticism from across the Muslim world over its Islamophobic stance. Our Islamabad correspondent Javed Rana says some Pakistani lawmakers are not in favor of expelling the French ambassador because they don't want to jeopardize their ties with the West.
The TLP, the political party which had organized all these protests, they had an agreement with the government, and government has now decided to implement that agreement. Under that agreement, a resolution would be passed in the parliament, and if parliament decides, if parliament approves the resolution, only then the French ambassador could be expelled from Pakistan. Now, everybody knows in Pakistan that for the parliamentarians, it is not that easy to skip the passage of the resolution because they have to go back to their home and they have to seek vote from the people. And people would not forget that they did not stand for the honor for the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So it is a very risky job for the Pakistani MPs not to be part of the passage of the resolution. At the same time, we have also seen that the Pakistan People's Party, one of the mainstream party, has decided to boycott the proceeding. Now, in a way, they don't want to displease West because, of course, they have good links with the Western countries. They don't want to jeopardize that. And at the same time, they don't want to be seen to be standing with the France on this particular issue.
The United States says it's planning talks to reposition some of its troops in countries neighboring Afghanistan after it withdraws from the Asian country. The U.S. Central Command chief said Washington wants to keep its forces within the region so as to keep pressure and surveillance on, quote, violent extremists. Kenneth McKenzie added that the Pentagon is weighing options to continue surveilling and potentially attacking those groups from neighboring countries. McKenzie, however, didn't name any specific nation for the repositioning of American troops. The U.S. country has almost 2,500 military personnel stationed in Afghanistan. The Iranian president says Tehran will return to full compliance with its obligations once the U.S. removes all sanctions it has imposed on Iran. Hassan Rouhani said Iran needs to verify the removal of sanctions first. He said Iran will then dismantle any activity which may not be in line with the 2015 nuclear deal and fully abide by its commitments. The president reiterated the best way to settle the standoff over the Iran nuclear deal is to fully implement the agreement. Elsewhere in his remarks, Rouhani touched upon the hardships that U.S. sanctions have caused, especially for the country's economy and medical sector. He said the sanctions have hampered and delayed Tehran's efforts to buy coronavirus vaccines. Negotiations to revive the Iran nuclear deal adjourn in Vienna with plans to restart next week. Iran's leading delegate, Abbas Araghchi, says The sides will focus on the sequence of measures that need to be taken by Iran and the U.S. Omar Ezgi reports.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their fifth session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Two working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran, and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the U.S. Now, a third expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, the most important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the U.S. to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Omar Ezgi, Vienna.
Elsewhere, the U.S. ambassador to Moscow says that he will travel to the United States this week for consultations, days after the Kremlin suggested that Washington recall him. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said John Sullivan would go back to Russia after visiting his family and members of the new administration. She added that she was not aware of a meeting scheduled between Sullivan and President Joe Biden. Separately, a State Department spokesman said Sullivan's return to Washington is coming at, quote, an opportune time as the administration formulates a new approach to Moscow. Sullivan's decision comes amid a diplomatic crisis between the two countries. Russia recalled its own ambassador to Washington last month, and the two powerhouses imposed tit-for-tat sanctions on each other. The Arab League, the United Nations, the European Union, and the African Union have called for an immediate and unconditional withdrawal of all foreign forces and mercenaries from Libya. In a statement, the so-called Libya Quartet rejected external military intervention in Libya as unacceptable. The UN estimates there are around 20,000 foreign troops fighting for warring sides in Libya. According to UN experts, the fighters are from Turkey, Russia, Chad, Sudan, and Syria. The Libya Quartet also demanded full compliance with all UN arms embargo on the war-torn country. The embargo came into force in 2011 after former ruler Muammar Gaddafi was toppled in a NATO-led operation. Chadian Transitional Military Council says it's not seeking to seize power after the country's president died on Monday.
By putting in place a transitional military council, the defense and security forces are not seeking to seize power. We would like to reassure people that the members of the transitional military council will return power back to a civilian government through free and democratic elections within 18 months.
The council's vice president said security forces have taken their responsibilities to defend Chad's territorial integrity and prevent the country from falling into chaos and anarchy. On Tuesday, the military council named Mohamed Idriss Deby, President Deby's son, as the interim president. A Chadian rebel group said it rejected a military transition led by the president's son and pledged to march on the capital. Idriss Deby died on Monday during a battle with rebel groups in the country's north. Deby had ruled the country for 30 years. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality.
Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The month of God. In the name name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. Imam Ali, peace upon him, asked Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, Messenger of God, what is the best deed in the month of Ramadan? The Prophet answered, the best deed in this month is refraining from sin. Dear friends, refraining from sin becomes more difficult when a person is exposed to sin. In other words, when there is the motive and the ground is set for committing sin. Scholars of ethics say that the human soul, that is self, is an unruly horse that will not obey the rider, so it will go its own way if it is set free. Therefore, it should be harnessed and directed in the right way. If it is left free, it will lead human being to precipice and ultimate destruction. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says in Sermon 176 of Nahjul Balagha, do know there is no act of obedience of God which is pleasant to do. And there is no act of his disobedience which is unpleasant and devoid of carnal desire to do. Thus, may God have mercy upon him who abandons carnal desires and pleasures and suppresses the self. The most difficult deed is to prevent the self from carnal desires because the self is always seeking transgression and hedonism. There are some acts that nullify fasting. Eating and drinking are some of them. Some other acts include inhaling thick dust, drowning the whole head in water, intentional vomiting. Dear listeners, the point to note here is that all these acts nullify fasting only if they are done intentionally and with free will. Dear listeners, the point to note here is that all these acts nullify fasting only if they're done intentionally and with free will. So, if for instance, one eats something while forgetting that he is fasting, his fast will not be nullified. Also, if someone is forced to eat or drink something, his fast will not be nullified. If the gum is bleeding, one should not swallow it. He should rather let it be mixed with the saliva and then he can swallow it. This way, his fast will not be nullified. Moreover, if the thick dust is inhaled, it will not nullify fast until it reaches the throat. Dear listeners, if you remember the first part of Dua Iftitah, that is opening supplication, teaches us politeness of servitude in the divine court. The second part was about seeking intercession with the Prophet of Islam and his Ahlul Bayt. Meanwhile, in the third part of this supplication, we plead to God to hasten the reappearance of the Savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi. We read, O God, and bless the owner of your authority, the hoped Qa'im, and the awaited justice, and engulf him by your nearest angels, and endorse him by the Holy Spirit, the highest angel, O Lord of the worlds. O God, make him your representative on earth, as you made his predecessors representatives. Authorize him in religion that you are pleased him with. Change his fear to security so that he worships you while associating no one with you. O God, Dignify him and dignify others by him, and help him and help others by him. And make him victorious with a great victory, and make him conqueror of an easy conquest. O God, make your religion and the practice of your messenger manifest by him so that he does not hide anything of truth out of fear of people. In this supplication, we continue to plead to God to solve our problems by Imam Mahdi, saying, O God, indeed we are eager toward you in a noble government whereby you dignify Islam and his people and humiliate hypocrisy and his people, and place us in it among the callers to your obedience and the leaders to your way. O God, connect our disparity by him and unite our discrepancy by him, and amplify your littleness by him, and dignify our humility by him, and change our poverty by him to richness, and pay by him our debts, and fill by him our rifts, and ease by him our hardships, and illuminate by him our faces, and free by him our captives. O God, fulfill our demands by him and answer out prayers by him. O, the best of those who are asked and the most open-handed of the generous. Cure by him our chest and remove by him the grudges of our hearts. And guide us by him in what there is difference in truth with your permission. Indeed, you guide toward the right path whoever you wish, and make us by him triumph over your enemy and our enemy, O rightful God. Amen.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The subcontinent.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people. Please stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about reports of hype and panic in Pakistan over the repayment of a hefty loan to the United Arab Emirates. Then we explore the impacts of such a move on the economic situation of the debt-ridden country and the future of Imran Khan at the helm of a ship sailing through troubled seas.
In 2021, March was the cruelest month for Pakistan, with April yet to come. Mid-March was the deadline for the repayment of a big slice of a huge loan back to the UAE. Nobody would expect the so-called friend Abu Dhabi to ask for the whopping $1 billion. So the news of the Emirati move sent shockwaves across the country. Deposited with the State Bank of Pakistan, the amount has now reached its maturity, and draining such a volume of money can be the coup de grace for Premier Imran Khan.
Since Abu Dhabi asked Islamabad to repay a $1 billion chunk of its loan, which was due mid-March, there are unconfirmed and sometimes conflicting scenarios about the economic and political future of the country. The $1 billion loan was part of the $6.2 billion initial bailout that helped the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to avoid default on international debt obligations back in late 2018. Islamabad says the main reason behind the delay in the return of the loan amount is the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on its already weak economy. And it is true. According to the World Bank estimate, amid the pandemic, Pakistan's real GDP growth has shrunk. According to the State Bank of Pakistan, the foreign debt and liabilities of Islamabad have increased to a total of over $115 billion until December 2020. In addition to the colossal damage of such a move on the country's economy, it will have massive political consequences for Pakistan. Imran Khan is under extra pressure now, as its government has received about $7 billion in gross foreign loans itself in only in 2020 to 2021.
There are many reports saying that the top Pakistani officials have made repeated attempts to reach out to the Emirati Crown Prince, seeking a one-year extension to return the loan. Moreover, many people are certain of a rollover, and some believe that it is again China that will come to the rescue. However, none of the scenarios may lead to a more popular Imran Khan.
For a country like Pakistan, with multiple incidences of internal and external conflicts, Imran Khan has come to be a skilled sailor, since the seas of South Asian politics seldom see the calm. Earlier in March, the captain had to garner a vote of confidence from the lower house of parliament, following a surprise electoral defeat on a Senate seat earlier in the week. Khan, who was elected to power in a general election in 2018, is the founder of Pakistan's Tehreek-e-Insaf party that leads a ruling coalition. The party experienced another boost when the Senate elected ruling alliance candidate Sadiq Sanjrani as the chairman of the upper house of parliament. Sanjrani, the incumbent whose candidacy was supported by Imran Khan, received 48 votes, with the opposition's Yusuf Raza Gilani receiving 42. Despite a relatively robust standing in domestic affairs of Pakistan, the fact that the United Arab Emirates has moved to withdraw financial support of Islamabad indicates a widening gap in their bilateral relations. Pakistan doesn't seem to have the money to give back. Therefore, even the prospects of losing such a loaded friend has the ability to induce panic in Pakistan's politics.
Last year, when Saudi Arabia announced a similar demand, Pakistan's all-weather friend China came to Imran Khan's rescue. Thanks to Beijing's handsome help, Pakistan paid back $1 billion out of the $3 billion loan that it had secured back in 2019 to avoid default. Now, many expect China to do another trick and get Pakistan to safe shores again. But why lend money to someone when you're sure of their inability to pay back?
Pakistan's economy is severely dependent on international support. This is why the country is deep in debts with almost no real possibility of payback. The financial assistance packages by Saudi Arabia and the UAE helped Pakistan to buy time to negotiate a deal with the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF. But the implementation of the IMF deal has been itself in limbo for over a year now.
Unfortunately, IMF has totally gripped the economy of Pakistan, and the country, Ministry of Finance and all the financial institutions are acting completely what the IMF wants, because they have, I many times said this, that the IMF have first planted their people. They have given the positions in the current government. There are the key elements and the key figure of the Imran Khan government are the people who were the employees of the IMF previously. So right now, so it's mean that the country economy has been hijacked by IMF. And currently, the situation is getting worse and worse. And if the situation goes on, I think that the country is going towards some sort of the major bankruptcy.
Pakistan returned the Saudi loan by securing three different financing pipelines from China. Beijing gave Islamabad $1 billion as soft loan, a credit swap financing line of $1.5 billion and $500 million commercial loan from the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. The Chinese assistance helps the State Bank of Pakistan maintain the gross foreign exchange reserves of around $13 billion. Currently, the Pakistani government is trying its best to revive the stalled IMF bailout program. As part of the IMF conditions, the government is amending clauses in the State Bank of Pakistan Act of 1956 on the definitions of the monetary liabilities of the central bank.
IMF has a plan that how to suck the blood of the people, and how they will take all its control into the institutions, because this is a strategy. When IMF want to cripple the economy of any country, or they want to put the country towards a bankruptcy, they use such kind of the tactics. So similarly, if I will give you an example, that how what's going on in Lebanon now, that their economy is moving towards the barter system. So that is horrible and alarming. So we can see the similar situation is going in Pakistan, because the major sectors of the economy who were the source and the revenue generation sources, they have almost finished. So in that condition, Pakistan economy has been handicapped by IMF by planting their own people into the Pakistan government.
A rollover may be able to postpone Islamabad's problem for some time, but the media frenzy over the UAE move was indicative of Pakistan's strategic significance in the geopolitical alignments of Asia and the entire world. Saudi and UAE pressure is pushing Pakistan towards China, as well as perhaps Iran and Turkey, something the United States and probably India never like. On the other hand, Washington needs Islamabad to keep its foothold in Afghanistan, which is itself getting closer and closer to China. Pakistan is a centerpiece in many of the regional puzzles that we have today.
The network of political alignments around Pakistan is complex, and any slight shifts can lead to big consequences. The recent row over the return of UAE's loan further proved the case. Pakistan is among the rare countries in the world with cordial ties with both China and the US. Washington needs it for better reach in Afghanistan, and Beijing needs it for access to the Indian Ocean. It is a good partner to its western neighbor Iran, but has a history of adversary against India, which in turn has historically friendly connections with Iran. Saudi Arabia and Iran can't get along together, but both value their relations with Pakistan. It does not seem to be about the money. By playing the money card, the UAE may be just mimicking Saudi gimmicks to threaten the government, force Pakistan into Israeli ties, or whatever manipulation they deem favorable. But no matter their objectives, unexpected changes in dynamic systems don't necessarily lead to favorable results.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to learn more about this, we are joined by Mr. Kamar Cheema. He's a strategic and political analyst. Mr. Cheema, welcome to this show. So, why has the UAE demanded repayment of its $1 billion loan back from the debt-ridden Pakistan? What does Abu Dhabi want to achieve other than its money?
Well, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia has demanded the money back. The reason behind is that when they gave the money, obviously Pakistan was not thinking that there could be other things which the Emiratis and the Saudis may ask. And while Pakistan had to lose the financial autonomy was no more with Pakistan. So the Saudis and the Emiratis want to take away our autonomy regarding the foreign policy choices. So what we have learned through the sources is that the Pakistan has been asked to recognize Israel. So while the Pakistani government has decided not to recognize Israel because Pakistan's founding father, Qaid Azam Muhammad Ali Jinnah, has made it clear long ago that we cannot recognize Israel until and unless there is a two-state solution for that. So that was the reason that the Emiratis are trying to pressurize Pakistan, and it's just not the $1 billion which the Emiratis are demanding. The other challenge is that the visas have been banned for the Pakistanis. So the Pakistanis are unable to secure the position in UAE which the other countries can secure. So this is a kind of a challenge that Pakistan had to face by not recognizing Israel, and we had to lose our foreign policy choices. We have been asked to compromise our foreign policy choices because of this.
Wow, really, something really astonishing. So you talked about Israel, of course, but is Abu Dhabi's move somewhere around removing Imran Khan from power, and will he survive such a political upheaval? What are his options?
Well, Abu Dhabi really doesn't want to remove Imran Khan from the power. He doesn't want this, and they will not try to micromanage in Pakistan's politics. They have not been doing it even in the past. But primarily, the choices for Imran Khan has reduced, because when Imran Khan came in power, he had to go to the UAE and to the Saudi Arabia for asking money for the financial challenges we were facing. So, and that was the reason that even the International Monetary Fund gave money to Pakistan, that the Saudis and Emiratis were providing us some of the financial bailout plan. So they don't want Imran Khan to come go out of the power, but definitely they want that we should compromise on our foreign policy. For example, Pakistan didn't go to Malaysia when there was a session that was called by Mahathir Mohamad, the former Prime Minister of the Malaysia, to have a session parallel than the OIC. And at the same time, Pakistan has been asked to, that Pakistan is asking the Emiratis and the Saudis to call a special session of the foreign ministers of the Muslim countries so that they can talk on Kashmir. But unfortunately, rather calling that session, calling that particular session, we have been facing challenges, and that challenges are that we have been asked to not to rely or not to depend on any kind of foreign policy bailout from the Emiratis and the Saudis.
Mr. Cheema, our team has collected a few global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could just take a look, and then we can continue. Thanks.
Earlier this year, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and Pakistan reached a staff-level agreement to release $500 million as part of the larger loan pact. The year 2019 saw the international financial institution agreeing to provide a $6 billion loan to the country to rein in the debt crisis in exchange for reform measures. The Pakistani currency hit over a one-year high at 156.99 rupees against the US dollar in the interbank market in mid-March, as flow of foreign currencies remained high compared to outflows. The inflows have kept the currency's foreign currency reserve stable at a 13-month high of $13 billion and strengthened Islamabad's capacity to make international payments mainly on import and foreign debt repayment counters. The analyst said the latest recovery in rupee was partially backed by the reports that the UAE would roll over soft loan worth $1 billion to Pakistan. Islamabad was scheduled to pay off the loan last Friday, March 12th, but the transaction did not take place. Pakistan has found itself in stronger standing, with a Saudi-led bloc of Arab nations having managed to mend a rift while maintaining ties with another alliance with Iran and Turkey that is challenging the Saudis' leadership of the Muslim world. After the Pakistan-Arab League rift emerged in August, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates asked Pakistan to repay $4 billion in loans taken out in 2018. Then in December, the UAE suspended the issuance of work visas to Pakistani nationals, a move experts said was designed to pressure Pakistan. Out of the committed $6.2 billion, the UAE disbursed $2 billion. It did not make the $3.2 billion oil financing facility and also withheld last $1 billion cash disbursements. Finance Ministry sources had told the Express Tribune that less disbursements by the UAE as against the commitments were because of Pakistan's decision to avail $500 million cash support from Qatar. The UAE has already rolled over $1 billion deposit for another year, which matured in January this year. Despite the drop in global remittances, two of the world's largest recipients of remittances, Pakistan and Bangladesh, registered a rise in flows in 2020 compared with 2019. Pakistanis working abroad sent home more than $2 billion for the eighth consecutive month in January 2021, with Saudi Arabia and the UAE emerging as the biggest contributors to the remittance inflows in recent months. UAE-Pakistan remittances in January 2021 was recorded at $2.3 billion, up by 19% from a year earlier, the country's central bank said. Pakistanis living and working in Saudi Arabia and the UAE contributed the highest inflows during from July 2020 to January 2021, amounting to $7.9 billion in total. A Saudi group that had originally bought the Karachi Electricity Supply Corporation, now called K-Electric, in 2005, has re-entered the scene amid an impasse over the future of the power utilities business relations with the government following the downfall of Arif Naqvi, the British-Pakistani businessman who was the founder and chief executive of the Dubai-based private equity firm, the Abraj Group. The owner of the Al Jomeh Holding Company of Saudi Arabia, Sheikh Abdul Aziz Hamid Al Jomeh, spent the day on separate meetings with President Arif Alvi, Prime Minister Imran Khan, Ministers for Finance, Energy and Privatization, and some other important stakeholders.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Chima. So, moving ahead, what are the economic and political consequences of removing such a huge amount from the Pakistani economy?
Well, first of all, it will have a direct impact on the foreign exchange reserve. which is very less at the moment. I think around $14 billion foreign exchange reserves are with the central bank. This is the first economic challenge we will face. Definitely, it will have a challenge for any foreign direct investment because if there is no money in the central bank, all the FDI, they keep on looking the macroeconomic indicators, and the government of Pakistan is trying to keep the macroeconomic indicators in a good position so that they can attract the foreign investors. So this is one thing which is definitely going to be a challenge when it comes to economics. But politically, it will have the impact that Pakistan's Kashmir policy has got weakened because Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and particularly the Saudis and the Emiratis, they are not supporting Pakistan on this particular issue of Kashmir. And since they believe that Pakistan is not taking care of their choices regarding recognizing Israel or making or having a starting a debate in Pakistan about the recognition of Israel, so why to listen to Pakistan on that? And above all, the Emiratis, we have been asked, not by anyone, but we have been asked by some of the quarters in the Middle East that we should not be as neutral as we are when it comes to Iran as well. So particularly, I believe that Pakistan's political choices will further be compromised because Pakistan wants to keep a position of neutrality in Middle East, particularly in the Saudi-Iran impasse.
Okay, Mr. Chima, the UAE's call happened only after a few months after a similar measure by Saudi Arabia. Are they connected?
Well, it seems that that there is some kind of a connection between the Emiratis and the Saudis on this, because personally, I find that the Saudis were not happy when Pakistan took a stance that Pakistan is not going to recognize Israel. So, and at the same time, we were not supporting the Emiratis and the Saudis on when they waged a war in Yemen. And Pakistan's parliament decided that we are not going to send the troops in Yemen and there will not be any boots on the ground. So this was a very turning point where the Emiratis were not very much happy on this. And somehow the GCC and these Arab countries, they try to have a unified policy on Pakistan because Pakistan talks to all of these for a support on Kashmir issues. So, and we wanted a collective support from the platforms like Organization of Islamic Cooperation and from the GCC, but unfortunately we couldn't. So there is some kind of a unity between the Saudis and the Emiratis.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chima. Unfortunately, it marks the end of our show. And thank you for your very commendable comments. People have voiced their opinion on social media and cyberspace. And let's just take a quick look.
Faisal Ali Shah said on his Twitter post, "Very challenging situation for Pakistan. UAE demands loan back at the same time as defense and others deal with agreements signed between Israel and UAE. Keep in mind, Pakistan is under pressure also to join Arab-Israel alliance against Iran." Mayank Jindal believes that UAE announces $10 billion fund for investments in Israel after a phone call between Mohammed bin Zayed and Netanyahu. Zayed says $1 billion will come from Pakistan as loan reimbursement and $9 billion will be scheduled investments. Tarun Khanna reacts on his Twitter account and says, "I wonder who will help Imran Khan to pay back the loans and which territory of Pak will be kept at stake." Mansi believes that UAE is behaving like an old Hindi film zamindar, who just wants to have the poor farmer's land and house in return for the loan the farmer took from them. Muslim Brotherhood is dead, it seems. Poor Pakistan.
And that was our episode about the aftershocks of the UAE request for repayment of its big loan from Pakistan and the political dynamics of economic ties between Abu Dhabi and Islamabad. We shall meet next week.
limelight.
Talk of peace in Afghanistan, Yemen, the streets of the U.S. is not coherent while waging wars with drones, says Brian Terrell, writer, in an article titled Biden's Drone Wars. Stay tuned for the details, please. On Thursday, April 15th, the New York Times posted an article headed, How the U.S. Plans to Fight from Afar After Troops Exit Afghanistan, just in case anyone misunderstood the previous day's headline, that is, Biden Setting Afghanistan Withdrawal says it is time to end the forever war, as indicating the U.S. war in Afghanistan might actually come to an end on September 11th, 2021, almost 20 years after it started. We saw this bait-and-switch tactic before in President Biden.